sell me on reasons to want you. I don't need you to search for the proof that I should. You don't have to convince me. You don't have to be scared you're not enough. 'Cause what we've got going is good. Of all that's been broken, I don't need you to fix what I'd rather forget. Clear the slate and start over. Try to quiet the noises in your head. We can't compete with all that.
On Broadway for Sunday, December 11, 2016. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Starshine. The reason it may be annoying, but the reason I'm doing is that one of our readers had mentioned it would be wonderful if when James says good morning to Peter, he would say good day. reference to She Loves Me, and I think he did in fact do that last week. So I was trying to think of other musical theater good mornings, and I don't think there were too many, but we got two so far. We'll see what else we can come up
with. Later on this morning, Matt Tamanini is going to join us. And of course, Matt is Broadway World's senior TV and film critic and host of Some Like a Pop podcast, which is available on iTunes and Stitcher. You can also connect with Matt at Twitter at BWWMatt and also Today on Broadway. So Matt will join us later when we talk about Hairspray. All right. So first up, the three of us got a chance to see Dear Evan Hansen. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with Dear Evan Hansen?
Well, it's a very good musical, and you don't need me to tell you that because the reviews have been fabulous. And not only that, when it was at Second Stage last year, it was very good, too. There was much acclaim for Ben Platt, and I understand why. He's playing a guy who is so neurotic that he makes Woody Allen look like those Scientologists who claim they're in the clear. So he does it very well. He never stops moving his hands. He never stops moving his feet. I don't mean in dancing. There is, I think, no dancing or very little of any kind in the show. But he's a true nervous wreck. That's who he's playing. And I am sure that he studied very, very hard such people to give such a detailed performance in what many people think will be the best musical actor Tony winner come this year. Could very well be. I'll tell you, though, the one thing that doesn't jive with me is that the girl that he loves winds up falling in love with him. Now, let's explain the fact that in this show, we have a situation that is a little on the odd side. His psychiatrist, which, believe me, this kid needs, has told him to write letters to himself. So he writes letters saying, Dear Evan Hansen, blah, blah, blah. Well, let's just say one of them falls into the hands of a young man who commits suicide. And so his family naturally assumes that Evan Hansen was the best friend of this young man, and they adopt him. Now, the young girl I'm talking about is one who is the sister of the suicide. So I do understand why she would certainly have some affection for this kid who is really helping the family to get through this. He's doing an excellent job, and he becomes a surrogate son. But there is a very interesting line in the play where she points out the fact that everybody in school is being nice to the dead girl's sister. And under those circumstances, I would think that there would be at least one boy who is much more handsome, much more together, a guy who doesn't move his hands and feet incessantly, a guy who doesn't laugh after every, let's say, stupid thing he does. He does a lot of stupid things. A lot he gets trapped into, I'll admit, but nevertheless, he does a lot of stupid things, and the self-deprecating laugh comes up, I would say, at least in one out of every four sentences. So while I think she would appreciate him like a surrogate brother, since he has become a surrogate son to the other, to the mother and father, I don't think there would be a relationship of that kind there. I think this would be a kiss on the forehead kind, because he just doesn't strike me, when he's with her, he doesn't even strike me as somebody who has changed. It's not as if this experience has emboldened him or empowered him at all, because he's really worried about being found out. Eventually, in the second act, you know something's going to come to a head. I won't say what, but nevertheless, something does. And but the change from the Ben Platt throughout the entire show isn't very dramatic, that when he feels empowered or when he gets taken down. It doesn't seem to matter very much. I also think the ending is a tiny bit pie in the sky, unbelievable. But there's no question that when this show works, it works extraordinarily well. The songs are by Pasek and Paul, a team that's always worth watching, tremendous work. And they're, I hesitate to say 11 o'clock number because that implies something else. But the song that takes place near the show's end, dealing with the fact of when Evan's father left the family, well, it's just a smart idea for a song, and it's beautifully realized. I also want to mention Rachel Bay-Jones, because she plays his mother. And the thing is, she has a nervousness about her, too. And you can really see that this is this woman's son. So I think that's pretty powerful as well. So a good show, maybe even a great show, but one that does make me ask a few questions here and there. So but I'm glad it's a hit, and I hope people attend it.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
Well, I think this show breaks a lot of rules and for the most part does it brilliantly. It's highly original. One thing, Peter just mentioned that song at the end, which Evan's mother sings, So Big, So Small. That's the one you're referring to, right?
Mm-hmm.
But so that's an incredibly emotional, intense song. And it's immediately preceded by another incredibly intense emotional song that Evan sings called Words Fail. Now, normally you would never do that in a musical, but again, they really break the rules, and they're so skillfully that it works. Pasek and Paul are on an incredible roll, Benj Pasek and Justin Paul, in addition to this show, which seems to be an absolute unquestionable hit in terms of not only the critics but box office. They have written the lyrics only, not the music for some reason, for the new film La La Land, which is apparently a big hit. And they also have coming up music and lyrics for a movie called The Greatest Showman, which is, I guess, an alternate musical about P.T. Barnum starring Hugh Jackman. Did you know all that?
Mm-hmm.
So they're really on their way. And I love their previous work, including Dogfight and A Christmas Story. So I'm very happy for their success. I think they're incredibly talented. I also agree about Ben Platt. I thought off Broadway that he was giving a spectacular performance, and it must be extremely taxing. To be that much of a nervous wreck. I mean, you can see there are times when he's practically vibrating because he's so anxious and sweating, and it really is extraordinary. So I'm sure that he's going to be well rewarded at awards time, and that's extremely well deserved. I have had some problems with the show from the beginning, not necessarily the same ones Peter had. I think, first of all, that I think it's entirely plausible that Evan's therapist or psychologist or whatever would give him that assignment. And it's possible also that the therapist would say, write these letters to Dear Evan Hansen, because this is presumably an older person doing that. But my problems begin with the fact that I don't think that it would be believable that anyone would think that this note came from the boy who committed suicide, Connor, just because I cannot imagine that any 16-year-old boy would write dear certainly not to a male friend. So that's first of all. And then there's the issue. They take great pains in this show to make it plausible that it would be believed that the letter was written by Connor and not by Evan. But aside from everything else, I'm not 100% clear. Are we supposed to think that the very first note, the one that falls into Connor's hands, the one he takes, he swipes it, and that's why people think that he wrote it to Evan. Are we supposed to think that that is an email that was printed out?
Oh, I always got the impression it was written out in the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, I would just imagine it's Microsoft Word, and he printed it at – he was in the computer lab, and he printed it, and the other guy picked it up off the printer.
All right, so that does solve one problem, because obviously if it's an email, and even if you print it out, it does show the address from which it came. All right, so let's assume that's true. And then after that, they're good about it, because Evan's friend Jared, played by Will Roland excellently, says, they decide that they need to create and backdate emails supposedly from Connor, the boy who killed himself, in order to comfort the family and make it seem that he really did have a friendship with Evan. So that's all well done. I initially thought that and I also said when we discussed it last time that I don't think that anyone would address intimate notes to a friend by using their full name. So I think it could have just been that could have been handled just by changing the title of the show to Evan, Dear Evan, or Evan Man, or something, some kind of nickname that they had. I also thought at one point I thought, well, what if he tweeted him? Because tweet addresses often are a person's full name, correct?
So yeah, if you get the address first, yeah.
Like at Evan Hansen. Right. So I thought it could have been that. But there's two problems with that. First of all, a tweet only has 140 characters, which is not necessarily a problem because they could have, just said that he could have had sent multiple ones to him. But then the other thing is there again, if you first of all, I don't think anyone ever prints out a tweet. And tweets always show where they came from. Right. The account that they came from.
They can. Yeah.
Yeah. So so anyway, I was trying to think of fixes, but I guess ultimately it's not that important because several people during the course of the show start to realize that the story doesn't make sense. And even if the things that they point out as not making sense aren't necessarily the same specific details as I'm pointing out, the fact is that generally speaking, they think there are holes in the story. Which of course there are because it's all a fabrication. So that makes me feel better about it. And also the score is so great. And for the most part, I think the book by Stephen Levinson is extremely well wrought. Everyone seems to behave in very realistic ways. The relationship between Evan and his mother and his absent father seems very, very true to me. And as far as the parents of Connor who kills himself, the way they deal with it or don't deal with it, the extent to which they can emotionally grasp it, I that all seemed very, very, very real to me. So I think it's a brilliant achievement, and especially because it is so original. It's got so much more worth to it in terms of the subject matter and the skill with which it's put together than so many other shows. So I'm very, very happy for its success, despite little details of plot holes that I may seem to identify.
So the only thing I have to add into this, a few things, is that it seems It seems like it's so tight right now. It's in such a good groove. And I wonder if it's that because the second stage production was so recent, and they also had another production down in Washington, D.C. at Arena. And it seems so I not in a bad way. It seems like it's really it flows really well, which I was very surprised about, because so much of this dialogue is so fast and overlapping, and how Benj does that same sort of delivery every single night. It's amazing. Who's his understudy? Does anybody, do you guys know who his understudy is? I don't know off the top of my head. Let me see if I have it in the book here. Jared Kleinman is the understudy for Evan.
Michael Lee Brown. Jared Kleinman's a character.
Oh. Understudy for Evan and Jared Kleinman, Connor Murphy. Oh, Colton Ryan. Yeah, thanks for correcting that, Peter. I really felt great about the whole show. I, having had seen it at Second Stage and really liking it a lot, we actually bought additional tickets and took our kids to go see it. And the kids loved it. The other thing I wanted to mention is that the audience that I was at was very, very young. Teens and 20s, permeated the audience. The house was totally sold out. People were waiting for cancellations in front of the theater. So it seems like it's a big hit. And we had word this week that the advance is $10 million on this so far. And it's in its first week of being open. So this is building up. The use of technology in the creation of the show, in the environment, and the projections and the walls that moved around is very interesting. But I wonder how that's going to age the show if this becomes a long running hit. Do you guys have any opinion on that? The use of that type of thing?
Well, that's a good point, because I think it's already aged a little bit, as I indicated, that yeah. Just the fact that it's they're not tweeting, you know. They are tweeting, but that's not the main crux of the plot. So yes, I guess unless they keep rewriting it, well, it'll just have to become a period piece. You know,
we'll drone mention, and say it's dated, which I hate when people do. Because period piece is a perfectly fine thing, perfectly fine indeed. So, yeah, that is the danger of being up to date in technology. The technology surpasses while the show stays frozen. So there's nothing you can really do about that. I doubt that they'll update it. It'd be much too an overhaul to do that.
What were you saying, Michael?
Oh, a friend of mine saw it at Arena Stage, and he noticed, and he knows the show pretty well, so he noticed at least two major changes in the score. He says that "You Will Be Found," the number that ends Act One, was new since Arena. I think it was off Broadway, but it was done off Broadway. But the song in Act Two, where Evan and Connor's father bond over how to break in a baseball glove, he said that was either completely new or much expanded from Arena. So they have been working on it. It's not. It hasn't stayed the same since then.
Yeah, I was going to ask if either of you had noticed a difference between Second Stage and Broadway. I didn't really notice any major differences.
Nor I, but apparently since it was done at Arena, yes.
Yeah, and the technology thing also. I just was going to mention that. Not that it was a mainstay of the show like it is in Dear Evan Hansen, but Rent is somewhat dated in its in the technology that they talk about in Rent.
RAZT too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Some of the cultural pop references in Rent don't land the way that they did when Rent first opened up.
And can't be expected to.
No, absolutely.
I'll tell you what Dear Evan Hansen will conceivably have a problem as time goes on, and this may not be relevant for 10 years. But even though it deals with teenagers, I'm not sure that this is going to be done in many high schools, because high schools get very nervous about subjects involving suicide. In fact, many high schools don't even like doing Carousel because Billy Bigelow commits suicide. Listen, they're going to make plenty of money. Don't misunderstand me. But nevertheless, I just it's a rare teenage-centric show that doesn't land with teenagers in high schools. But we may only be seeing this in community theaters, or at least in very few high schools. Yeah, colleges too. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I've seen Dogfight twice in college already, once at NYU and once at Harvard. So so obviously they know who Pasek and Paul are. And so, yes, colleges, but I don't know if we're going to see it in high school. It'll be very interesting to see what happens to these amateur rights.
You know, it's interesting, James's comment about shows being dated, and maybe this is an incredibly obvious comment, but it seems the shows that when they're written, when they are dealing with present day, those are the ones that later are viewed as dated. Whereas if I were to write a show tomorrow and set it in 1925, no one would say it was dated. So that's just an interesting.
And it becomes charming. It becomes nostalgic, right? Yeah, different set of circumstances, right? Weren't we silly then? Yeah,
exactly.
So as I mentioned before, Dear Evan Hansen is selling very well, and their advance is very good, and it seems to be a audience favorite and a lot of Broadway buzz inside. So we'll see how it takes on the rest of the season. We'll have to wait to see.
There is a lot of humor in it, I hasten to say, in addition to the very moving and tear-jerking part. My friend who I went with was prepared at when we got to the end. We both started sniffling, and he had a bunch of napkins he had brought from a restaurant, not tissues, but napkins. And he handed me a napkin so I could dry my tears. And I just thought it was so cute that he was prepared for it. You know, he had a whole bunch of them. It was really cute.
I tell you, it's a perfect opportunity for Kleenex to sponsor a Broadway show. They should have Kleenex boxes on the aisles as a going out of the theater. They should do that. Okay, so next up, Peter got a chance to see In Transit. So Peter wanted to tell us about the a cappella musical.
Yeah, in terms of a cappella, let's start with that. And so you don't hear any instruments at all. I guess this is John Doyle's nightmare. Who knows? But when you come right down to brass tacks, what's really wonderful is you don't miss it at all. At all. It really seems as if instruments are playing. That's how skillful the actors are in this show. You know you're at a show for young people when two people kiss and the audience goes, ooh, not quite that, but second cousin to an ooh. This is an excellent show for millennials. It's an excellent show for New Yorkers. We often hear that New Yorkers don't go to the theater anymore. This may bring them back. I hope it does. But I don't mean to say that any other age group is excluded, because we can all relate, those of us who live in New York, to any woe that is on the subway. Before it began, I turned to my buddy Ken Bloom and said, I imagine we're going to see a rat, don't you, since this place takes place in the subway? And he said, oh, absolutely. And sure enough, there deep in the show, a rat runs across the stage. Not too close to anybody, so and needless to say, it's not a real rat. But Bill Berlone was not asked to come in and train a rat. So, this deals with a whole bunch of New Yorkers who have their problems. There's a gay couple. Faithful listeners may recall that we talked to Telly Leung recently about playing a gay man who's very much in love with a talent agent, and they're planning to get married. Only problem is he comes from Texas and he hasn't told his mother. And it's one of those things that it will kill her if I tell her, but he's got to tell her if they're going to get married, because they're really making those plans. There's the inevitable actress who is right now a temp and hopes that that's going to change. And perhaps her big break will come as time goes on. a lot of different a guy who lost his job because he made the dreaded mistake that almost all of us have made, and if we haven't yet, we will in the future, when you mean to reply and you send reply all, and that all includes somebody who's being criticized in that email, and it's not long before you're going to unemployment. So all these New York stories, all very effectively told. In a way, this is a great grandson of On the Town, because it is quite the New York musical. But if On the Town is bittersweet at the end with its song Some Other Time, this show is uncompromising in only giving us semi-happy endings. And I think that's very good of it. Very good indeed to only give us semi-happy endings, because there's no tying up neatly with a bow in any of these stories. Good things may still happen to some people. Certainly bad things will, because that's life and that's New York City. So now there's also a character named Boxman, who's really a genuine subway musician who makes those strange sounds while having the microphone close to his mouth. What's really so impressive is that when he takes that microphone away from his mouth and he has to deliver lines, and he does, because he becomes friendly with the young woman I was talking about who wants to be an actress, who's a temp at the moment. And but when he, I'm telling you, when he takes away that that microphone and he has to speak lines, he's terrific. Just terrific. Now, there are two of them. I saw Stephen Heaven Cantor. There's another one named Chesney Snow. But I can certainly say that Stephen Heaven Cantor is an excellent actor who I'm sure is even surprising himself, because I can't imagine he's, given that he's been a subway musician, that he's spent much time taking acting classes. But he's a natural. So very strong cast. Very strong show in many, many ways. I will admit that these guys worked very, very hard to get every single one of the annoyances you can find on a subway, from the car you go into that smells terrible because a person's been in there who hasn't had a home in a while, down to the first one, which is you know, we're stopping in a moment because spacing out of trains, you know, that one that we hear all the time. Don't tell us your troubles, you know, just get us to where we're going. So, but it doesn't all take place in the subway, by the way. It does not. And it has to go to different locales. And the way that the scenery slides on and off, circling the square, is very, very effectively used here. So, so kudos, really, to James Ellen Ford, Russ Kaplan, Sarah Wordsworth, whom we don't know, and Kristen Anderson Lopez, who we do know. And I hope they have a hit. I think they deserve it.
Well, I'm excited about that. Michael and I, Michael, you're seeing it this week?
Yes.
I'm as well as seeing it this week, so maybe I'll see you at the theater, and we'll be back and report our findings next week. But until then, let's move on to the next thing, which is A Bronx Tale, which is a musical based upon the film, based upon the show, based upon Charles Commentary's thing that we all saw at the Paper Mill Playhouse, but now it is on Broadway. We got a chance to see it again. Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
Well, by the end of the first act, I really liked it. I thought they had done an excellent job of adapting it as a musical. I think the score by Alan Menken and Glenn Slater is very good overall. I like the fact the music is a lot of it is doo-wop influenced. There's some kind of Sinatra 60s swing type stuff. And I think the musical language is great. I think the book is credited to Chess Palminteri. And I think that his part in the adaptation was also very well done. In Act Two, I thought it started to become very cliched and formulaic, and it lost me to a large degree, I'm sorry to say, because I really, by the end of Act One, I thought, gee, you know, they did a really good job of this. And also direction by Robert De Niro and Jerry Zaks. I don't know what the division of labor was, but I thought it moved very well and all of that. I think that Nick Cordero, who has been a guest on our podcast, was superb in the role of Sonny, the mobster, which is a difficult role because he's supposed to be a very complex kind of guy. You understand why young Calogero admires him, even though he is basically a killer. And you definitely understand the conflict of young Calogero's allegiance. Should his main allegiance be to his father, who's a hardworking bus driver, but just a basic, you know, simple man, or to this flashy mobster that's kind of a celebrity in the neighborhood? I find that all very believable. I just thought in Act Two, it just seemed kind of predictable and formulaic and cliched. And also, I don't know, I'm not sure why I say this, but there's a subplot of Calogero, or C as they begin to call him, falling in love with a black girl. And it's not that that wasn't compelling so much, but it just seemed like it didn't fit in well with the major plot so very well. That was an issue for me. I've never seen the movie. I assume all of that is in the movie.
I don't know.
Well, okay. I haven't seen the movie either. Yeah.
I'll have to catch up with it sometime. And I will also say, I'm going to follow Peter's lead. He was very circumspect in not mentioning one of the lead actors who I really did not think gave a good performance at all. And I think that impacted the show greatly. I don't know if it was how much of it was that actor's issue or how much of it was the direction, but I think that it would have been a much better show with someone who seemed more invested in what was going on there. So I think maybe we should leave it at that.
So I was thinking about I thought it was fine. It was an okay show at Paper Mill. I thought it got a little bit better on the Broadway stage, and exactly what Peter had said, when they moved from Paper Mill to the Broadway stage, it actually became a tighter playing space, and I thought that helped the show a lot. And focus what was happening on the stage. I still feel as though that this is not as strong as the other offerings that we have this season, and that it just, maybe it's too soon on the heels of Jersey Boys. It seems so much like that without as strong a product as Jersey Boys is. And I wish everybody well with this, but I don't think that we're going to see it around after this year's award season. It's selling really well.
And speaking of Jersey Boys, they are so marketing it. I was watching TV the other night, like sort of half watching TV while doing something else. And I looked over and I saw the sound was down, and I saw a commercial, and I saw in huge letters on the screen, Jersey Boys. And I thought, oh, well, you know, I mean, they are still running commercials for Jersey Boys. At least they have been recently. But it wasn't a commercial for Jersey Boys. It was a commercial for A Bronx Tale. Yeah. And they're really trying to sell it. That also, if you go to the theater, those ads, that ad signage, those things that hang down from the marquee, on one side, it, in huge letters, it says Jersey Boys and West Side Story. So I guess the subplot that I mentioned of Calogero falling in love with the black girl is the West Side Story part of it. But those are the two shows that they're marketing it on, and I guess it's working so far. I do, as I said, I think there's a lot of good in it. I should mention Sergio Trujillo's choreography. I thought it was really great. And, there's a lot of talent involved. It's just and it is worth noting that however we feel about it, I think it's kind of extraordinary. We have now had three big hit musicals open in the fall on Broadway within a few weeks of each other. This one, Dear Evan Hansen, and Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812. I can't remember the last time that happened. So I guess that's only a good thing, right?
Sure, sure. Actually, there have been a total of 17 openings already in this new season. And I don't know, do we count Paramore as a hit musical? I have no idea. But but it does, it's part of this season as well. Granted, it didn't open in the same cluster as these other shows. But it is a new musical.
Well, I just meant, you know, in recent years, it seems like seasons are always backloaded. Okay. And cool. Almost everything opens in the spring. So
frankly,
not
a
much
lot
open.
Will. Yeah.
And we still have more coming. Yeah.
There's a lot scheduled for the spring. We should talk for a split second about the Lyric Theater where Paramore is playing, and the news last week that Paramore will be moving to another theater not yet described, because the Lyric is going to be closed and undergoing major renovations to bring in the Harry Potter musical from London. So that's interesting that is mentioned so far in advance and locked up, and that they're going to close that theater. And have you seen the on 44th Street, the renovations of the Helen Hayes and the St. James have started, and there's a nice, I guess maybe 20-foot wide alleyway in between the two theaters now. And the Josh Ellis office, we could talk a little bit about that, is now, which was part of the Helen Hayes, is now gone.
Right. Mm. Yeah, the alley was always there, actually. But
it was just blocked, yeah.
Yeah, now you can see it very, very easily. Well, in terms of that Paramore, where are they going? That's the real question. And I won't be surprised if they close.
Yeah.
But I think maybe we're looking for a new theater as a euphemism for a little bit later hearing we couldn't find one and what a shame and all that. I won't mind if they buy the Hellinger and put it in there. I think that would be a nice idea.
Yeah.
And I don't even think that's totally impossible. We've certainly lived in a year where we've seen things that we thought were impossible come true. So maybe a good one will happen now. That could very well be. So we shall see what we shall see. But my prediction is they're going to close.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's I don't doubt you. And I think you're right. But then what does that make of the – what was the figure we heard? Was it $200,000 or much – that the producers of Harry Potter are supposedly paying for Paramore to get out?
I had heard figures as high as $20 million.
$200,000 is very low. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it wasn't that. Yeah. I mean, that seemed odd.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the Ambassador Theater Group is, you know, it is a worldwide organization, and I think that they're looking to the future and bringing in the Harry Potter thing and seeing where they can run this.
Hudson Theater doesn't have a booking yet, though, does it?
No, Hudson doesn't, but we were talking about on Today on Broadway, we were talking about the Hudson Theater not being large enough for Paramore.
No, of course not, of course not. No, I just meant...
No, it doesn't have a booking yet, no.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Matt has created this ultimate spreadsheet of productions circling New York to come in, along with theaters that and what their spaces are like and who's online to get in what theater and things like that. It's really interesting. So, but we do... We were talking about, I guess... Studio 54 was open and Hudson was open, but now 54 is going to be taken. So we have to see, you know, what would come into the Hudson, I guess, either a small musical or a play. Nothing just as of yet.
Well, back to the Lyric, apparently the renovations are going to include moving up the back wall of the theater and reducing the number of seats by, what did they say, 400 or 500, which, you know, maybe should have been in the first place. I'll never forget when that theater opened, Garth Drabinsky, later a criminal, led a tour of it for the press. And he was going on and on about how intimate it was. I swear to God.
I was there too. I can vouch for that, Michael. I was at that as well.
That's right. You mentioned. And yeah, he was going, I remember specifically, he said that the furthest most seat from the stage is no further than blah, blah, blah. And it's less than, you know, this other theater. And he was doing all this stuff, but somehow everyone has always seemed to feel that there's just a barn-like feeling to it. And I do think that if they're going to continue to have Broadway type shows in it, that they're making the right decision. I always thought if they just had arena type things in it, And that's why when Paramore went in, I thought, well, maybe this is an indication of another way for it to go. But one way or the other, I guess they're deciding to try to make it more Broadway show type friendly, and hopefully that'll work.
I don't have any figures, but it feels like that ceiling is so high and the space over the orchestra is so open and vast that it makes it feel like that barn, that the mezz doesn't go deep enough into the orchestra to make it feel intimate.
I think that's the main thing, and it's also very wide. It's a very wide theater. But we're talking about millions and millions of dollars of renovations if they're going to replace the back wall and move it
up. Sure.
All right. So next up, the three of us got a chance to get out to the Paper Mill Playhouse. This is our little Paper Mill section with Bronx Tale and The Bodyguard. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with The Bodyguard?
Well, this is a jukebox musical, and it really is a jukebox musical in that so many times we say jukebox musicals when all we mean is shows with recycled songs. But these are songs that really could be in jukeboxes, and I'm sure they actually were. Except for one, which is Jesus Loves Me. You don't expect to hear that in a jukebox musical, but you do in this one. To be fair, it's in the 1992 film on which this London-imported musical has been based. And it's full of power ballads because it deals with this superstar who's getting threatening notes and therefore needs a bodyguard, even though she doesn't want a bodyguard at all. And that leads to all sorts of complications, including a romantic one, because as she says to him, "Look, if you're going to be my bodyguard, I don't want you hanging around on my dates. So the only solution I can see is for you to be my date." And, that brings up a real problem, because if you've seen the movie, and I have, you will know that Kevin Costner in the movie is just manic about keeping her out of the public eye and making sure that every little possible breach of any type is plugged up. So when he gets there to her house for the first time, he points out all the problems with the house that nobody has realized that he can fix or will have fixed. So in the musical, not in the movie now, in the musical they've added a scene where he takes her out to a nightclub, and she challenges him to get up. It's a karaoke bar. And she challenges him to get up and sing. And he sings very badly. It's the only time in the show he sings, by the way, which is kind of interesting, because you don't get many musicals where the title character doesn't sing. My buddy Barry Monish reminded me that Finian and Finian's Rainbow doesn't sing, but there are very few, if any others. So he gets up there and he does a very purposely awkward rendition of I Will Always Love You. And but then what he does is encourages her to get up and sing. And it's not long before everybody in the bar says, "Oh, my God, it's Rachel. Oh, my God." Well, what is the logic in this, that he's trying to be so protective of her, and then he gets her up in front of people and lets everybody know that it's she? I mean, it makes no sense to me whatsoever. So I think that this new scene is a real liability. I think it has to be in there. I guess it was in there to give him something to sing and to make him look a little human and silly. I guess that's successful in doing that. But and the actor Judson Mills is his name, does a very nice job of being this stern type of no-nonsense, life is tough guy. So Deborah Cox has the part that Heather Headley originated. And really, people talk all about the time about how Barbara Streisand had such a big workload in Funny Girl. I don't think this one is any different. And we talk about Ben Platt as well having quite a workload, and he does. Wow, Deborah Cox is involved with virtually every song, virtually, and certainly rarely leaves the stage. So she's very good. Very good indeed. And so this is a competent show. It reminded me very much of Bronx Tale in that, yes, you go, you sit there, you see the numbers, you agree that they're not out of place, they're fine, and then you go home. It doesn't make a tremendous impact, but it's an affably okay night at the theater and a competent musical more than anything else.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
I thought it was one of the worst, most painful shows I've ever seen in my life. And literally painful because, like too many other shows, including some really good ones like The Great Comet, they keep shining lights directly in the audience's eyes. I hate that. Am I the only one who finds it incredibly painful?
That's rock concert stuff. And they want this to be a hybrid, to be a rock concert and a musical. Yeah.
And my wife and I talked about that exact thing on the way home. And we're like, oh, you don't have to do that. There's a way in which you can shine the light in the audience if you want the rock concert feel without hitting the audience members.
Exactly.
In the eyes. And we talked about, it's funny, we talked about that same exact thing. So you have lots of fans on your side right now with that.
But why did they do it? Did they think it's not exciting? It's just painful. People are covering their eyes. It's, you know, I mean, stop it. Don't do that. But I was equally assaulted by the stupidity of the story, which, you know, it's funny. I had never seen the movie. After seeing the musical, I thought this is the most idiotic plot I've ever heard in my life or seen in my life. And then I looked up a synopsis of the movie, and it seems like it's equally idiotic, but somewhat different. Apparently her sister fits into it very differently in the movie. Is that true, Peter?
A little bit. They've soft-pedaled what happens with the sister in the musical. The sister is far more germane to the plot in the movie.
And then another thing is apparently in the – again, this is just from reading the synopsis. In the movie, the person who's stalking her is not the same person who's trying to kill her. It's two different people.
Yes. By the way, since you bring that up, there's a terrible bit of staging at the end of the show when somebody tries to kill her because the audience is way ahead of what's happening, way ahead because of the incompetent way that it's staged. In the movie, Kevin Costner has a split second to realize what's going on and solve it. Here, the way it's staged, I mean, I understand that they're going for a different type of reality, but the way it's staged looks like he has about 2 minutes to figure out what's going on. And it's not at all surprising in the way that it is in the movie. So that's a problem in this musical. Go on, Michael.
Yes. And I don't know why they didn't do that. Why didn't they just have him stand up right before he was about to shoot her?
Indeed.
Rather than stand for a full minute.
Yeah, I know. Really. That was pretty bizarre.
I don't know. I guess but you know what? This was directed by Thea Sharrock, for whom I have absolutely no respect whatsoever, ever since she basically destroyed Equus. I mean, how can you destroy the effectiveness of Equus? But she somehow did it. But even if you like her work, if you read her credits, why in God's name would they have thought of her to direct this type of a show? I mean – nothing she's done is anything like this. I don't get it. I do agree about Judson Mills, who apparently he doesn't actually say this, but someone told me that he has not been on stage since he was in college. It seems like he went straight to TV, soaps, and then nighttime TV, and has a tremendous amount of TV credits and also feature films. Major League 3, Mighty Joe Young, Chill Factor, etc. I thought he was perfect in terms of having really seeming like this kind of guy would be very self-contained and very professional. But there again, that leads to which this I assume has got to be in the movie. I mean, he's so professional. He really is determined to do his job as best as he can, but then suddenly he starts having an affair with her, sleeping with her, and then almost immediately he regrets it and said, "This has got to stop." I don't think that's part of his character at all, but I guess they had to do it in the movie because people wanted to see Kevin Costner and Whitney Houston sleeping together, and they thought they needed the romance in it. But I think it could have been more interestingly handled if they didn't actually have an affair, but maybe wanted to, if they just kept that tension there through the whole thing. That would have been more interesting to me.
Well, I guess we needed that song to start the second act when she gets out of bed. And this is where jukebox musicals always fail, because they usually have relevance for the first or second line of the song. But then at one point, Rachel sings, "He gives me more love than I've ever seen in one night. I'm impressed. That's pretty good." Yeah, all right.
All right. So I'm going to give it my Minority Report here and say I loved it.
Oh, good.
I loved it. I had a great time. I think it's going to be a huge hit, and I think they're going to bring it to Broadway. And it's playing in 5 productions around the world right now. And I don't think for any split second of a moment it is deep, great theater, but I had a great time. Certainly there are all those problems that you're pointing out, and I would love it if they took out the shining lights in my eyes, but we had a great time, and Deborah Cox was amazing, and Judson Mills was great. And I think that this is fluffy Joseph Mamma Mia type of fun, hear great songs and amazing performances. And I think it's going to be a huge hit on Broadway. I'd be very surprised if it weren't. You know,
well, there were lots of Niederlanders running around at the at Paper Mill, and they are producers, co-producers. Yeah.
So I think that lots of people, it's heading out. Let's see where it is. It's they don't.
It has a long road tour, right?
A lot of road tour things here, which makes me wonder if they're going to have a. If they're going to have a second company open on Broadway, or if they'll take the road tour and then bring it to Broadway. There's New Jersey, Minneapolis, Appleton, Memphis, Chicago, Columbus, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Charlotte, Durham, Nashville, Atlanta, New Orleans, Tucson, Sacramento, San Jose, Los Angeles, Costa Mesa, San Diego, Dallas, Fort Worth, Kansas City, and Houston.
Wow.
So, I mean, that seems like a good year or more out on the road. I would think that they're going to bring it to Broadway before that. So we'll have to see what happens.
Yeah, although as we were discussing earlier, considering what has already opened and what's to come, maybe they would be better to wait at least till after
next summer. Yeah.
It sounds from all these cities. Yeah,
exactly. So, yeah, and the cast recording is out there already, and but it doesn't have Deborah Cox in. It's got somebody else in the cast recording. So we'll see what happens with that. Next up, Michael, you saw the Wild Party Project's production of Anna Christie. So tell us about that.
The Wild Project.
Oh, did I say party? I have written down here the Wild Project. Did I say Wild Party? So the Wild, the Wild Project's production of Anna Christie.
Yes, I had not been to the Wild Project, which is it's not exactly convenient. It's at 195 East 3rd Street between A and B, and I never take buses, so I just take the closest subway I can and then walk. But it was really worth it. This is actually my favorite Eugene O'Neill play, because I think it's a lot more concise than his later works. Oddly enough, I think there's also a lot of humor in it, aside from all the melodramatics. Ironically, I read in later years that O'Neill disowned the play. And I just thought it was ironic. The only one I really like is the one he disowned. But anyway, I think it's got a lot of really rich characters in it. It's about this young woman, Anna Christofferson, who is about 20, and she is reunited with her father, from whom she's been estranged for 10 or 15 years since she was a little girl. He had sent her off to live on a farm in Minnesota, which sounds like, you know, maybe an idyllic life, but it, unfortunately, it didn't turn out that way. She wound up, it's hinted that she was, well, maybe raped or abused, and then she wound up perhaps becoming sort of a prostitute. So she definitely has a past, but she's trying to get away from all that. And she shows up in New York. Her father is a seaman. He's currently a captain of a coal barge. And his name, believe it or not, is Chris Christopherson. And so she they have a reunion, and it doesn't go all that well because there's so much history and baggage, and she kind of resents him for abandoning her as he did, even though he thought he was doing the best for her. And it just didn't turn out that way. And then she meets a sailor named Matt Burke, who gets picked up by the coal barge after he's in a shipwreck. And he and Anna, he's a very Irish, manly kind of guy, very basic. And he and Anna develop this very strong attraction to each other. And they, there are lots of rocks, in that relationship, but they actually wind up together, in the end. All Wilderness is often billed or said to be, O'Neill's only comedy, and I understand why people say that, but in a sense, this one is too. Nobody dies, and it does have a happy ending for all of the serious content. If you don't know Anna Christie, I would say go to see it at the Wild Project, because this is a really stellar production directed by Peter Richards. Teresa Plain, Plahen, is fantastic as Anna. I did think that maybe she had a little bit of a modern day feel to her, but not in any really negative way. She has a beautiful voice, a very beautiful, sexy, low voice, which is appropriate to a role which was made famous on screen by Greta Garbo. This was the movie, by the way, the movie of Anna Christie was the movie that was billed as Garbo Talks. That movie was simultaneously made in German with a different cast, except for Garbo. She's in both. So I think those are both still available. You can see those if you want. Stephen D'Ambrose as Chris Christopherson was so fantastic. He seemed so authentic, including his accent. And same for Ben Chase as Matt Burke. Really excellent accent work, in that case, Irish accent. And he and Teresa Plain, Ben Chase and Teresa Plain, had so much chemistry on stage. I was reminded that this was the play in which the Roundabout did a production of it years ago. And that was the play in which Liam Neeson and Natasha Richardson basically hooked up and then got married and mm-hmm. you know, and were together for years. That was people got to see. I missed that production, but people got to see this this incredible bond, you know, romantic and sexual forming between these people on stage, and I don't know if that's happening in this production, but it certainly seems like the chemistry is there. And then the other two, the only other two people in the cast, Tina Johnson as Marthy Owen, which is the Marie Dressler role in the movie. She was also wonderful and authentic, and really seemed like she was that person on stage. And even the guy playing the bartender, Johnny the Priest, Scott Aiello, was superb. I think this director really deserves a lot of kudos, Peter Richards, for finding these people and casting them so perfectly and leading them to these really excellent performances. Even the set, as simple as it was wonderful, and it even has really convincing fog effects at one point, which, as anyone who knows the O'Neill oeuvre knows, fog is often very important in his plays. So I highly recommend it. It's only running through December 17th, but if you can get to the Wild Project at 195 East 3rd Street, it's so, so worth it.
All right. So also you got over to the Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS fundraiser Gypsy of the Year. So tell us about that.
Yes, I hadn't been in a couple of years just for scheduling reasons. And I wanted to go the specific reason I wanted to go was that I heard that this was going to be the last appearance at Gypsy of the Year for Jersey Boys because it's closing in January. And I had heard that they were getting like 60 past cast members to come up and do the big number as the finale. And that was as exciting as I thought it would be. There were a lot of alumni that I noticed on stage, including Andy Carl and Peter Grigas, who's been with the show forever. I think he put the number together. So that was great. But two of the other most exciting things were things I hadn't heard about. The opening number started with, the ensemble theoretically rehearsing for Gypsy of the Year. And the number they were doing was Turkey Lurkey Time from Promises, Promises. And then three of the girls who were doing the number walked to the side and had some dialogue indicating this was supposed to be the 2020 revival of Broadway revival of Promises, Promises. But then, wouldn't you know it, at the other side of the stage came on the three original Turkey Lurkey Time girls, Bjork Lee, Donna McKechnie, and Margot Sabbington. Well, the audience went absolutely nuts. And that was before they even started doing the original choreography and singing the number. So that was an unforgettable moment. The Gypsy of the Year and the Easter Bonnet competitions with all the skits and numbers that they have, they always tend to give a big, big nods to Broadway history, and they can always be counted on for that. They did a huge West Side Story tribute when I guess it must have been the 50th anniversary of that show, and in that case they brought Cheetah back and the original Bernardo, and Carol Lawrence was in it. So they if you want to see that kind of stuff, you should try to go to these shows. That was an amazing highlight. And then the other moment that was so beautiful it made me cry was a very simple moment where the cast of On Your Feet came out and sang Seasons of Love from Rent in Spanish. And it was just so – it's so simple but so beautiful. It really made me cry. A lot of the numbers in this edition were informed by what has happened with the presidential election and people's fears and sadness and anxiety over all of that, but also the hope that, you know, we all have to keep in our hearts that we're just going to keep going, and hopefully it won't be too bad and it'll all be over, in 4 years. So hopefully that's what will happen.
So Gypsy of the Year raised $4.5 million for Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS. Jersey Boys is going to be sorely missed because they were the top fundraiser this year with $322,000. Hamilton was runner-up with $293,000, Book of Mormon $202,000, and Lion King $168,000. Those red buckets after shows, $4.5 million happen in there. So that's really really an amazing job done by them.
And I'm told that Jersey Boys itself at the very end of its run has moved back into the over $1 million a week.
Yeah, gross.
And that's probably a combination of the fact that it's closing, but also they put in Mark Ballas into it. And some people are suggesting that, you know, who knows, they might have tried stunt casting, if that's the word for it, or star casting, to keep the show going more. But the thing with Jersey Boys is you can't just, you know, you can't just put anybody in it. You really need people with very specific talents and abilities. So I think, it had a wonderful run, and maybe it's just as well that it's closing, and I'm sure that we'll see it again before too long, in one form or another.
So this past Wednesday was NBC's production of Hairspray Live, and Matt Tamanini from Broadway World has joined us to talk about that. So, Matt, welcome, and give us your thoughts on Hairspray Live.
Well, thanks so much for having me, James and Peter and Michael. This was an interesting one for me, and I'm not sure if everybody saw it or is waiting to watch it on DVR or something, but from a production standpoint, I thought this was by far the best of the three that NBC, or best of the four that NBC had done previously, with the other three being Sound of Music, then Peter Pan, and then The Wiz. The production was great. It obviously benefited from an increased budget and moving the production from one soundstage in the New York tri-state area to a backlot in Los Angeles, where it had multiple soundstages. It had, you know, backlot exterior scenes, and it definitely showed. In terms of the production itself, I thought it was fine. I love Hairspray on stage. I don't know that it translated as well as I probably would have hoped when it made the transition to the screen. But to me, the thing that really resonated the most was just the message of the show. And that's more innate in Hairspray itself rather than Hairspray live on NBC. And I think the message of acceptance, both personally and of those around you, was very powerful at this time in our nation's evolution. There were some fantastic performances. There were some less than fantastic performances. There were some technical things that I think worked really well, and there were some technical things that didn't work really well. Overall, it got positively mixed reviews. On the positive side of mixed, unfortunately, in terms of ratings, it was probably the worst. It is currently behind Peter Pan Live, which is not a good look for NBC, considering that was the low point of this four-year experiment. Obviously, every year that we move on, just in television in general, those immediate live ratings are going to shrink. That's just how television works. As more people cut the cord and watch either through streaming or purchase things they want to watch or watched on DVR. So I'm assuming there'll be a bit of a bump when the Live Plus 3s and Live Plus 7s come out. But I wouldn't imagine it would be a huge jump. So I'd imagine if it does surpass Peter Pan Live, it won't be by much. And considering how much, like I mentioned earlier, they increased the budget, the star power they went out and got, the advertising and social media push that they made, I'm assuming this is going to be a disappointment, at least from the business side for NBC, even though I think from the production side, it was probably one of the better ones they've done.
All right, Peter, what did you think about Hairspray Live?
I haven't seen it. For one thing, I was told that it was so chock-a-block with commercials. Mm-hmm. True, Matt, there was a commercial every other minute, it seemed.
It sure felt like it. But, I think we've talked about this before. They're expensive, so they've got to pay for it. So until they can come up with some creative way to get around it, it's going to be like that. But it did feel extra commercial heavy this year, Peter.
Yeah, the way of getting around it is having my friend fillet the commercials out of the show. So when he does that, and I expect to get it next Thursday, then I will watch it. I am looking forward to it. Matt, you mentioned that some performances were good and some were not. Can you be more specific in terms of which ones you thought were good and which were not?
Sure. I think the one that you have to mention first, and it, just because it's Hairspray, is that I couldn't have been happier that Harvey Fierstein got to play Edna. Obviously not exactly the vocal greatness that of the greatest voice that's ever done that role, ever been on Broadway, but the fact that Harvey gets to play that role, there's just something special about it. And I mentioned it when I wrote the review, is that Hairspray has a level of, you know, artifice and performance. It's a loud, broad musical comedy, but Harvey having done this role for so long, and the fact that he adapted the stage script into the teleplay for this, it just felt so natural and so lived in. It just felt a level of realness that the other characters didn't have. And there were some great one-liners, and you guys might know the show better than I do. I've seen it three or four times, but there were some great one-liners, and I don't know if they were originally in the stage script or if those were Harvey's, or if he maybe ad-libbed them on stage and kept them, but he was great. I thought Dove Cameron, who's a Disney Channel star who played Amber, was shockingly fantastic. My expectations are generally pretty low when they say, oh, we're going to cast a Disney Channel star in one of these roles. But she was shockingly fantastic. And I hope that we see her more, whether it's in musicals on stage or on screen. Unsurprisingly, Jennifer Hudson was in phenomenal voice. I know where I've been. What I mean, I get goosebumps just thinking about it right now. It was a fantastic performance, and I was pleasantly surprised with her acting. I didn't know. I mean, I've seen her in Dreamgirls, and I know she's done other things on TV and in movies. But I was really kind of moved by her motor mouth. Unfortunately, on the other side, Ariana Grande, who everybody kind of knows, got her start in 13 on Broadway. She was, let's just say, the weak link. She's known for having a very breathy vocal style, and she just, for some reason, refuses to ever sing consonants. So, unfortunately, that might be fine in pop music, but when it came to something musical theater centered, it just didn't work. I felt like she swallowed everything, and you've got to love Penny Pingleton, and you know, everyone kind of knows from the cast recording or having seen her how great and how funny Carrie Butler was, and this was just seemed like a missed opportunity in that role.
The girl who played Tracy,
she was good. I mean, I think she was fine. I think she didn't necessarily have that quirky, funny charm that the best Tracys have, whether it's Ricky Lake or Miss Marissa Jarrett Winoker, that kind of have that effervescence that just makes you really attracted to their personality, and I don't mean attracted like in a romantic way, just that draws you in. But she was fine. She sang well. She didn't have that nasal quality that I kind of associate with the role, but I thought from an acting standpoint, that's probably where she shined the most. Obviously, a performance for the screen is going to be different than on the stage, so maybe that's why she wasn't as over the top. But I thought she did a fine job. She sang fine. She acted fine. We maybe got a little more subtlety from her than we would have on the stage. But in the continuum of performances, she was in the middle. She was fine. Nothing uh-huh. great, but nothing terrible, in my opinion, personally.
Martin Short.
He adorable. I mean, I thought he was great. A huge improvement over Christopher Walken from the movie. But I don't know that that's all that difficult. But he was great. I mean, I think, you know, I'm kind of surprised having seen him do this, that he didn't ever do it on stage, whether it was on Broadway or in one of the, you know, the Hollywood Bowl concerts or whatever. I thought he was very good. I enjoyed him more in this role than I have in a lot of things he's done in recent years.
Kristen Chenoweth.
I was hoping you wouldn't bring her up.
Not for you, huh?
Well, no, I love Kristen Chenoweth. There was a time in my life when I would have done just about anything to have an evening alone with Kristen Chenoweth, but in a romantic, you know, Italian restaurant kind of way. But it just, she just felt poorly cast. From a comic standpoint and a vocal standpoint, it just didn't seem to fit what she does best. She was still Kristen Chenoweth, so it wasn't bad. It just felt like an odd match of performer and role to me.
Well, it does sound like if you do go out to dinner, you're going to have to pick up the check now.
Absolutely.
Okay, Michael, what's your take on Hairspray Live?
Well, Matt, I was going to say I agreed with you about every single assessment of the performances, except now, Kristen, I'm so surprised I have to disagree. I thought she was perfectly cast. I mean, she is a former beauty queen, isn't she?
Yes.
Not that that, you know, makes it. But no, I thought she was great. And I didn't mind the way that they added her soprano register into the songs, although I think it would have been more effective if they had only done it once. I think it was too bad that she didn't get her bow at the end due to one of the many severe technical flubs in the telecast. I also thought Derek Hough was excellent as Corny Collins. We should probably mention Garrett Clayton, who I thought was a huge disappointment as Link, because I didn't think he got the humor of the role. But also, I'm sorry, I have to say, why would you pick Kenny Leon as a director of Hairspray? I mean, does he have that kind of sensibility? Apparently not. I don't think so. I really don't think so. And I think he could have helped a stronger director like a Jack O'Brien or could have helped Garrett Clayton and Ariana Grande maybe to give more of the type of performances. And also, the girl who played Tracy, I agree with you. I think she was fine, but she just didn't have that kind of theatrical energy. Mm-hmm. And now it's difficult to – you know, I mean, it's a very fine line when you're doing something like this on television. But it is, and especially a show like Hairspray that's so over the top and quirky and kind of campy. You know, how big should you be, you know, without going over the way over the top? So I think that's a problem. I have a question for the three of you, though. I would really like to know, do you think that the live – do you think that doing these live, is it basically just a marketing ploy?
It would seem so.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that networks often fight about is trying to get people to watch live, because that is still, despite all the things I talked about with the progression of how people watch television, that's still how the ratings are generated for the most part, and that's how they charge advertisers. So getting people to watch live is really important, and one of the ways you do that is you make it live. We saw with the Rocky Horror Picture Show thing on Fox a few months ago, that was a startling disappointment in just about every imaginable way, both from a performance wise and from ratings wise, because why watch it live? It's not live. You know, there's an element of that. Anything can happen, where we saw in Good Morning Baltimore, Maddie Baglio, who played Tracy, she just completely dropped a line. She just stopped singing, and the background singers like echoed her like they were supposed to, but she never sang the line. That's something that I think there people want to see, that live element. But you're right, it's effectively just, you know, to try to generate viewers. And while that might not lead to the best production, that might be the best way to actually get it on air, because as we saw with Rocky Horror, it's tough to get these things done right, even if they're filmed.
Well, this is interesting. I didn't know this about the girl dropping the line. So the question becomes, do you think the rest of her performance was influenced by that? Was she therefore much more tentative and nervous as a result of saying, oh my God, I better not make a mistake again?
I don't think so. Michael, did you notice that she missed the line? I thought she rebounded great, because the next line it was about halfway through the song. But from there on out, she finished the song great. I didn't think it really impacted her from that point out. Did you, Michael?
I wasn't sure if she dropped a line or if the mic went out. And it's interesting, because initially I thought it was pre-recorded, because it's and I'm not the only person who said this.
No.
At the beginning of the number, it seemed like that her lips were not completely in sync. So I don't know what was going on. I mean, it could be that the vocal track cut out, or I didn't think that she actually stopped singing. Although I did notice that she was out of breath at a few moments during that opening number, because, you know, they were running down the street. You know, yes. I mean, and by the way, you know, at one point you know, it's a back lot, but it's supposed to be Baltimore, but the camera wasn't low enough, and you saw the mountains in the background. So,
the mountains of Baltimore. Yes.
Let me ask this, Matt. Now, given the fact that of these four that have been on NBC, Hairspray is the most recent movie to have been released. Do you think that's one of the reasons why people didn't watch as much as the other shows?
I'm not sure about that. That was something that, you know, figuring that in, really surprised me that they picked this in general. Obviously, Neil Marin and Craig Zidane, who have been the executive producers for all four of these live musicals for NBC, they also produced the film. So there's that connection. And I think, and without trying to, you know, read between the lines too much, but I think it's a fairly safe assumption that because The Wiz Live last year, which was directed by Kenny Leon, which is probably why he was retained for Hairspray, because that had such a multicultural aspect to it, and it was a significant increase over the ratings and the critical response from Peter Pan the year before, I think that might be one of the reasons they wanted to do Hairspray, to kind of keep that, you know, that diverse cast and then hopefully audience as well. So I would guess that's part of it. But, you know, James and I talked about this on Thursday or Friday's show of Today on Broadway. Outside of the circles that the four of us kind of live in, I don't know that Hairspray is the biggest draw of a show. Obviously, I think Grease and The Sound of Music, which, you know, kicked off these live things for both NBC and for Fox, those are huge names that are going to draw a lot of people. Peter Pan has the name recognition of the character. The Wiz has The Wizard of Oz. But Hairspray is just, it's based on a campy cult 80s movie. It had a very well-received stage show, but I don't know outside of the theatrical community if it's going to bring in a ton of viewers. So to me, that was more of the issue than the fact that there was a movie in 2007 done by basically, you know, the same producers. So I would imagine that moving forward, Bye Bye Birdie next year, man, that's a tough sell for me in terms of trying to get a ton of people there. Obviously, with Jennifer Lopez's name behind it, maybe that'll bring in some people that normally wouldn't watch. But I don't know that, again, outside of our communities, if Bye Bye Birdie is really going to resonate enough to really make a big impact on these ratings.
Would you be surprised if they dropped the project entirely?
I would be surprised, yes, because Jennifer Lopez is the star of another show on NBC called Shades of Blue. So they're kind of tied into the Jennifer Lopez game right now. And I think she's got a dance show coming as well. So I think it's as much about cross-pollinization as anything else for NBC. But I would not be surprised if it's a smaller production in a lot of ways than Hairspray Live was. Maybe there's not as many, you know, sets. Maybe it's not as big of a cast. Maybe it's, you know, a little smaller on the advertising and production budget. I think this was a huge disappointment for Bob Greenblatt, who's the chairman over at NBC and who has really championed and shepherded these musical projects on NBC, whether it's these live musicals or Smash. I think this was a shock to a lot of people. I'll be frank, I'm one of them. I expected this to do a lot well, but kind of analyzing it in retrospect, it kind of makes sense.
Well, whether or not they wind up doing or canceling Bye Bye Birdie, I thought it was very annoying that the commercial for it had Anne Margaret's vocal. I mean, talk about false advertising.
On when Matt and I talked about it on Today on Broadway, I brought up the fact that that maybe these once a year live musicals on NBC is NBC's kind of Tony Awards, because CBS has continued to support the Tony Awards with not great ratings every year, because it's a great a jewel in their crown, and great demographics of people who watch these shows are people with disposable income who have great demographics for advertisers and things like that. So maybe even if they might lose a little bit of money on it, they had a 9 million person live audience. We don't know about the following, because you can watch Hairspray Live on the NBC website right now, and also people that are DVRing it, and the possibility that they'll play it again during the holiday season.
They will, actually, on the day after Christmas, on December 26th, they're going to re-air it.
And also, Matt, the other day mentioned that there was a day shift from Thursdays to Wednesdays, so that might have had a little bit of an impact on it, as well as I didn't think that it had really big stars in it. I think Jennifer Lopez will bring some numbers to these things, but I think if they're going to do these things, they're going to have to star cast them if they expect big numbers. If they expect to keep going in the 9 to 12 million range, they can continue to do it with Broadway stars. And that'll be fine for us, but I don't think that they're going to bring in tons of new viewers. I mean, ratings seem to be down across the board everywhere. I mean, the NFL ratings are down. National Football League not getting ratings, that's unheard of. I mean,
well, but, to be fair, those have bounced back significantly since the end of the election. So a lot of that was tied into people kind of tuning into politics as opposed to sports. The NFL primetime games since that first week in November over the past month have kind of come back to normal ranges. So you're completely right in that ratings are down overall, but the election did impact a lot of things here recently.
Maybe if they made these musicals part of Shondaland, they would be very big. All right, so let's wrap up for the day. Before we go on to trivia, I want to remind everybody that you could subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. There's many ways to listen to us. One way is on iHeartRadio. iHeartRadio has the entire archive of Broadway Radio's podcasts. You can also listen to us on Google Play or anywhere else that you can listen to finer podcasts. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, for Matt, and for me can be found at Broadway Radio, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So, Peter, do you have an answer for last week's trivia?
Yeah, I asked about the time when there were four musicals that were the longest running tenants at their respective theaters, all of which had Rodgers and Hammerstein's names on their playbills title pages. What were the four musicals that once set these long run records, and what were the four theaters? So the four shows and theaters are Oklahoma, which played all of its 2,212 performances at the St. James, South Pacific, which accomplished 1,712 of its 1,925 performances at the Majestic before it moved to the Broadway Theater. The Sound of Music, which played 1,232 of its 1,443 performances at the LaFontaine before it moved over to the late lamented Hellinger. And finally, the fourth one, racking up 1,147 performances at the Imperial, was Annie Get Your Gun. Wait a minute, you're yelling. Irving Berlin wrote Annie Get Your Gun. Indeed, he did. But Rodgers and Hammerstein produced it. Notice I didn't ask for four Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals, but four musicals that had Rodgers and Hammerstein's names on their playbills titled pages. And indeed, Annie Get Your Gun did. Sneaky? Yes. But as Inspector Clouseau liked to say, every move I make is carefully planned. Anyway, David Schmidow was the first one to get it, followed by Michael Portantier and Ron Fassler. All right, so here's the new one. What do the 20th century years of 1934, 1936, 1943, 1952, 1956, 1962, and 1968 have in common? The years again: 34, 36, 43, 52, 56, 62, 68.
They can all be divided by one. That's my answer. All right. So if you have a better answer than I just came up with, email us at triviabroadwayradio.com, and we'll let you know if you're on the right path. So on behalf of Peter Felicia, Michael Portantier, and Matt Tamanini, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
What do you say?
I never thought there'd be someone like you who would want me.
Well,
so I give you 10,000 reasons to not let me go. But if you really see me, if you like me for me and nothing else, well, that's all that I've wanted for longer than you could possibly know. So it can be us, it can be us, and only us. And what came before won't come.
It'll be us and only us. And what came before won't count anymore.
We can try that. You and me, that's all that we needed to be. And the rest of the world falls away. And the rest of the world falls away.
The world falls away.